Chapter 7. I was too frightened to cry out again. Instead, I remained absolutely still, crouching in pitch blackness, while the wash of ship sounds eddied about me, sounds now intensified by the frantic knocking of my heart. Then I recollected that Zachariah's dirk was still with me. With a shaking hand, I reached into the pocket where I'd put it, took it out, and removed its wooden sheath, which slipped through my clumsy fingers and clattered noisily to the floor. "Is someone there?" I called, my voice thin, wavering. No answer. After what seemed forever, I repeated, more boldly than before, "Is someone there?" Still nothing happened. Not the smallest breath of response. Not the slightest stir. Gradually, my eyes became accustomed to the creaking darkness. I could make out the ladder descending from the deck, a square of dim light above. From that point, I could follow the line of the ladder down to where it plunged into the hold below. At that spot, at the edge of the hold, I could see the head more distinctly. Its eyes were glinting wickedly, its lips contorted into a grim, satanic smirk. Horrified, I nonetheless stared back. And the longer I did so, the more it dawned on me that the head had not in fact moved. Not at all. The features I saw remained unnaturally fixed. Finally, I found the courage to edge aside my fear and lean forward, the merest trifle, to try and make out who, or what, was there. With the dirk held awkwardly before me, I began to crawl forward. The closer I inched, the more distorted and grotesque grew the head's features. It appeared to be positively inhuman. When I drew within 2 feet of it, I stopped and waited. Still the head did not move, did not blink an eye. It seemed as if it were dead. With trembling fingers, I reached out and managed to brush the thing, just lightly enough to sense that it was hard, like a skull. At first I cringed, but then puzzlement began to replace fear. I touched the head more forcibly. This time it rolled to one side, as though twisting down upon a shoulder, yet all the while glaring hideously at me. I pulled back. By then I had drawn close enough so that, accustomed to the dark, my eyes could make out the head more or less distinctly. I realized that this human-like face was a grotesque carving cut into some large brown nut. Emboldened, I felt for it again, trying to grasp it. That time the head quivered, teetered over the edge of the hold, then dropped. I heard it crash, roll about, then cease to make any sound at all. Torn between annoyance for what I had done and relief not to be in any danger, I put the dirk back into my pocket. I never did find the sheath, retrieved the candle, and started climbing the ladder. Halfway up, I remembered my clothing, the reason for my being below in the first instance. For a moment I hung midpoint, wondering if I should go back and fetch some of what I needed. Insisting to myself that there was nothing to worry about, I groped my way back to the trunk, feeling for and taking up what I had previously laid out. Then I turned, half expecting to see the head again, but of course I did not, and, rung by rung, squeezing clothing and books under my arm, climbed to the top of the ladder. After closing the hatch's double doors, I crawled out from beneath the table and retreated hastily to my cabin. There I changed my clothes, and soon felt quite calm again. I was able to reflect on all that had just happened. The first question was, what exactly had I seen? A grotesque carving, I told myself, though I had to admit I couldn't be sure. Even if it was a carving, could a carving reasonably put out a candle? Surely that must have been done by a human hand. My thoughts fastened upon Barlow. On further reflection, however, I was quite convinced that, other than the candle, Barlow had been empty-handed. Yes, I was certain of it. Besides, though I hardly knew the man, he seemed too submissive, too beaten about, to be capable of such a malicious trick. After all, it was he who had warned me twice about possible trouble. But if it had not been Barlow, there must have been a second person, someone to place the head where I'd seen it. Once I put my mind to that possibility, I realized with a start that, yes, I had seen two faces. The first one, I was mortally certain, had been a human's, belonging to the person who snuffed out the candle, and who then, under cover of dark, set up the carving to deceive and frighten me. Though I prided myself on my ability to remember sights and sounds, I was unable to make a match at all between that face and any man I had seen among the crew. Someone new? That was impossible. We were at sea. Visitors did not stop to call. Very well, then, I reasoned. The person in the hold had to be someone I'd simply not recognized. After all, my sighting was the quickest of glimpses. But if I could not identify who it was, then the next question became, why had he shown himself? Why, indeed? To frighten me. I had no doubt about that. Well, then, to what end? To make me think that what I'd seen was not real? I recalled Barlow's words. Perhaps I was being warned. But why, I wondered, should anyone want to warn me? True, I had been told not to board the ship, and Zachariah's words concerning the crew and their desire to be revenged on Captain Jaggery for his so-called cruelty were unnerving, even if I did not believe them. Then, too, I reminded myself of the captain's own warning that the black man was given to exaggeration. There were too many puzzles, too many complexities. Unable to fathom the mystery, I ended up scolding myself, convinced that I was making something out of nothing. This, then, was my conclusion. It was I who had not seen properly. The candle, I decided, must have been blown out by a sudden current of air. As for the carving, no doubt it had been there all along. I simply had not noticed it. Thus I forced myself to believe that I had acted the part of a foolish schoolgirl, too apt to make the worst of strange surroundings. And so I found a way to set aside my worries and fears. "There now," I said aloud. "The proof is this. Has anything bad really happened?" To this I was forced to say, "Discomfort? Well, yes. But ill-treatment? No, not really." Still, I wondered if I should inform Captain Jaggery. Had he not just asked me to tell him of anything untoward? Had I not agreed? Upon careful reflection, I decided to remain silent. If I were to go to the captain with such a tale, he would think me a sorry, troublesome child. That was the last thing I desired. Such thoughts led me to consider my most pleasant talk during tea with him. He had left me in quite a different frame of mind than Zachariah had. Captain Jaggery and Mr. Zachariah, such unlike men. And yet, quite suddenly, I was struck by the thought that each of them, in his own way, was courting me. Courting me! I could not help but smile. Well, no, not courting in the real sense, but surely courting me for friendship. What a queer notion! But I must confess, it filled me with smug pleasure. I resolved to stay on the good side of both men. No harm there, I told myself. Quite the contrary. It was the safest course. I would be everybody's friend, though, need I say, infinitely more partial to the captain. With my morning's adventures so resolved, I, for the first time since my arrival on the Seahawk, felt good. But I was hungry. After all, I still had not really eaten for several days. Neither Zachariah's hardtack nor the captain's biscuits had been very nourishing. Just the thought made my stomach growl. I decided to return to the cook and request a decent meal. But before I went, I had one more task to perform. At the moment, it seemed trifling enough, though momentous it proved to be. I took up the dirk that had caused me so much anxiety and, since it had no sheath, wrapped it in one of my own handkerchiefs and placed it again in my pocket, determined to fling all into the ocean. At that fateful moment, however, I paused, recollecting that both Captain Jaggery and Zachariah had urged me to keep the weapon. What if each chanced to ask of it again? Here I reminded myself that a few moments before, when I'd been frightened, I had found a need of it, or at least I thought I'd needed it to defend myself. Finally, with the notion of pleasing both captain and cook, I returned the knife, still wrapped in my handkerchief, to its hiding place under my mattress. As far as I was concerned, it could stay there and be forgotten. Alas, such would not be the case.